and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. My guest today is designer, author, UX advisor, entrepreneur, game inventor, Dan Brown. He's a web designer who specializes in information architecture, design research, and leading teams. He has written three books, most recently, Practical Design Discovery in 2017, Designing Together in 2013, and Communicating Design in 2011. He created a card game called Surviving Design Projects to help designers practice their conflict resolution skills, and anyone who works in-house or with clients knows about that. And Dan co-founded 8Shapes, a UX design firm based in Washington, D.C., in 2006 with his business partner, Nathan Curtis. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for making time for the show today.
Thank you for chatting with me. I love talking to you.
So, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Practical Design Discovery, what motivated you to write that book now?
That's a great question. I love discovery. I love the early part of the design process. And I feel like this is, there's sort of this galvanizing moment that we're all going for when we start a new project, a sort of this kind of collective understanding of what it is that we're trying to do.
The moment when you get it, or when you and another team member go, oh, now I understand what their problem is, or, oh,
I got it.
I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's even better is when you're working collaboratively with a client or with your, you know, internal business stakeholders, and they go, oh, this is, yes, we've never been able to articulate the problem before in this way. And we've never been able to clearly see a solution in this way.
I think being able to articulate is such an important part of design practice, successful design practice. And it's tough. And being able to do it in a way that doesn't offend people is also tough.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you've been a consultant for, what, almost 20 years?
Yeah, I had some stints internally.
Sure.
But mostly externally, yeah.
So you've really honed that. Obviously, you can't stay in business as a consultant if you don't have those courtly skills, that ability to tell someone a hard truth, but in a way that makes them not hate you, not blame the messenger.
I feel like as I get older, I can be as direct as I want to be, and then people appreciate that more. Nathan and I started 8Shapes 10 years ago now.
Right.
And we started it on one of the principles that honesty is the best policy. And so we're always direct and upfront and honest. And the more I do that, no one's ever given me a hard time for being honest with them. So it seems to work. Now, you know, I'm trying not to be a jerk when I do it, but I also, you know, want to be as direct and as clear as possible in that communication.
This is interesting because, well, for instance, we're both dads. I have a daughter who has a problem, and we finally found someone who listened to her and understood that she's a thinking person describing a problem. But earlier, we would meet with people who supposedly knew how to deal with children, but they would sort of minimize and trivialize because she was young. And I think what you're saying is there's this arc over the course of our lives, and when we finally start falling physically apart and looking ugly compared to what we used to look like, that's when we can finally tell the truth and people go, oh, this person, we should pay attention. And it is hard at the beginning of a career when you're young a young person in their first design job gets fired for insubordination as if it were the military.
Right.
And maybe their opinions don't really mature as they get older. They just get social permission to state them.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't know. I think, you know, different people run their careers differently, but there's also a fine line between being direct and being arrogant.
Right.
And insubordination I think has this sort of flavor that comes with it, where it's not just here's the truth as I see it, but here's I'm right and you're wrong. And, you know, we also live in collaborative environments where facilitating those conversations, I think, is just as important as being direct.
Absolutely.
I think that
nobody really knows. I mean, anyone who thinks they've got, you know, they know exactly what the user experience should be and they've got all the problems mapped out in their head and they know exactly how to solve them. That's silly.
Right. Right. And I'm on this project now where I keep having they keep asking me very direct questions about, you know, what's the answer going to be? And I keep having to say, look, I don't know yet, but here's our path for getting to the answer. And if you're okay with that path, we're going to keep going. The challenge I have on this particular project is that their priorities shift, which, you know, it would be very easy for me to lose patience with, but also given the nature of the organization, it's kind of who they are. You know, it's kind of, you know, we sort of have to fly by the seat of our pants a little bit here.
It's always tough. We've started in my studio, we don't start with traditional proposals. We say, can we please take only a very little bit of your money and do some discovery? We want to, and good clients tend to say, yeah, because it's less risk for them. And you find out if you can work together, right?
Yep.
It's less risk to everybody involved. And it's also, to me, it's become increasingly clear that it's absolutely crazy the way we used to do things, say 10 years ago, where you'd say, yeah, we're going to give you 8 templates with, you might as well say, 7 dropdowns and 16 user choices and 32 paragraphs of copy. Like, you don't know. How can you possibly know? You know that they're successful in some ways. They have some business problems, not all of which you understand or know about yet. They're trying to solve problems, their customers have problems you don't know about. How can you possibly tell them, yeah, this looks like between 8 and 10 templates ought to do the job? It's silly. It's like saying, I'm going to shoot this in 20 scenes. What's the screenplay? Oh, I don't know. What's the story about? I'm not sure yet, but I know that it's going to be about 20 master scenes, you know, maybe 7 insert shots and a couple of close-ups. It's ridiculous.
It'll have people in it. That's all I got. So
yeah. Yes. There'll be motion and sound. But so I think when we started out, everything was so new that a lot of the traditional design thinking went out the window. And so, you know, you'd have a client who was somehow, they knew that they couldn't ask their graphic designer for 1,000 different layouts. But for some reason, they didn't understand that that was also true for the people doing their online user experience. So we got in the habit of saying, yeah, we're going to give you 2 designs to choose from, and here's why we do that.
And there's this ebb and flow that's happened over the last couple of decades too, which is that on the one hand, you know, we understood that software development took time. But on the other hand, the ability for us to produce high quality software became reduced, right? Or the amount of time it takes became compressed. And so there's this ongoing tension between do it well or do it fast? And can we do it well fast? Mm. And maybe if we break it up into smaller chunks, we can do it fast and well. But on the other hand, there are some problems that we don't understand well enough to break it into smaller chunks. So I think that the design world, the interaction design world, the technology world is sort of is really fragmented because we're trying to, generally speaking, tackle lots of different kinds of problems in lots of different ways. And in some ways, the book is a plea to slow down at least a little bit.
Up front.
Yeah, and just take a moment to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing.
I'm sure you know Erica. Erica Hall from Mule Design, who has talked about, asked why is failure acceptable now? Like the way that Silicon Valley has said, oh, well, you know, you spend $1 million and you find out this the business doesn't make any sense. So you pivot once or twice, and then, you know, you go out of business, and it's okay.
Yeah.
Nobody gets hurt,
yeah,
except all the people who liked the product and now can no longer use it, and all the people who worked for you and now have to look for new jobs.
Right.
She's saying, why is that okay? There's this sort of – it feels like – you're talking about ebb and flow. It feels like in our medium, in our industry, we went through Wild West, and then we got to UX, and let's figure this out first, and let's do it right. And then we got to, it's not real money, and let's do some sprints and see. And I think doing some sprints and see and test is great, but you have to start with some idea of who you're designing for and what problems you're trying to solve and why. If you don't have that stuff, you're just throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah, I feel like there's I've been trying to draw a parallel to Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. And I think this is going to be one of those things I'm thinking about for the rest of my life. But the basic premise of his book is that there's sort of, we have these two mental capacities. One is to make very quick judgments and sort of churn out a thought very quickly based on our prior experience. And then there's this other mechanism in our minds that that is more deliberative, right? It sort of takes a problem and it really thinks deeply about it. And I feel like there are these two parallel paths in a team as well. You know, the team has gotten really good at sort of, okay, give me a new screen. We know what it needs to do. We can throw it together. We can churn it out real fast and we can release it. You know, we've got this regular release schedule going.
Okay.
And then there's that other half that needs to be more deliberative. This is a problem that we're not familiar with, or it's a new feature entirely, or it's we're addressing a new user story or a new user group entirely. We can't just use the same old rote process that we have. We need to churn it out. We need to be more careful and more deliberate about how we approach that. When I was interviewing, I interviewed a bunch of product managers a couple of years ago to try and understand, like, tell me about the tension in your world. Tell me about how, I mean, it was really selfish. I was just trying to ask, like, how does a UX designer like me help you, product managers? And one person gave me this great quote. He said, look, you know, we're really good at kind of keeping our head down, churning stuff out. But 6 months later, you got to pick your head up and say, am I even building the right thing anymore?
Right.
And I feel like you can take failure too far, especially if you don't have that more deliberative path where you're taking a moment to reflect on the things that you're doing and ask yourself, is this even the right thing to build?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the story of the search engine gives the wrong results, and after 6 months of work, it gives the wrong results faster.
Yes.
Yeah. And like, so yes, you've done a lot of good, laudable work, but it wasn't the right work. You didn't solve the most important problem. You've written three books. I mean, all within the past, say, 6 years, how do you keep a practice going and you speak all over the place? How do you keep an active speaking schedule, an active client schedule, and still find time to write, you know, 20,000 words on a subject?
I have very patient partnerships in my life. So my business partner and I, Nathan and I, are, in a sense, generous with each other, give each other the space to scratch these itches. I really didn't want to negatively impact the 8 Shapes work. And actually, this last book took really a couple years just from proposal to launch. And that's because I was trying not to impact my client work too much.
Got it.
But, you know, in the past, he and I have sort of taken mini halftime sabbaticals, you might call them, to write a book or you know, do other things. You know, for us, the speaking is a big part of how we generate business, how we recruit. And so there's a real business need for us to kind of maintain that.
Right.
And then he and I think also like just keeping our finger on the pulse of the community. So we do, I would say a lot of our contributions, both of us get a lot of pleasure and professional satisfaction out of writing. So you see a lot of our work up on Medium now, used to be a blog, but we do a lot of that kind of stuff. And I think we both find that professionally satisfying.
Sure. Well, writing helps you figure out what you think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Do you miss the Eight Shapes blog? Do you care where you write?
I feel like I should have a stronger opinion about this. But I feel like Jeremy has said everything that needs to be said about that topic. So I don't really think too hard about it. Look, Medium is a really simple, easy to use tool. It allows us to kind of get stuff out there. We use the editing features a lot. So he and I will share work with each other so we can kind of comment on it before it goes live. I don't know. It does what it needs to do. So.
Well, I agree. I like the way it keeps you informed of who's reading your stuff, who's commented on it, which of your the writers that you like have published things that you should check out. It's really good at that. I wish my magazine. We keep trying, right. But it's one thing when you have venture capital, and it's another thing when you're a shoestring indie publication, and that's okay. Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I've got a lot of nostalgia for, say, the late 90s where, we were all firing up, movable type or what have you on, your own personal servers and things. That was a lot of fun. But as you say, right, I'm a small business owner. I'm trying to do things to, promote the business, promote the book. Like, I feel like it is a better use of my time to use existing tools rather than to tinker with those things behind the scenes. But that's just me. And different people are different.
So. Right. Well, so for me, I have a blog at Zeldman.com. When I write something, I then repost to Medium, gets different audiences. I'm okay with that. Someone has said, is Google penalizing you? I have no idea. I'm not doing it to try to trick anyone. I'm distributing my content. To me,
I'm not doing it for Google. Right, I'm doing it for myself.
Sort of like, would Google penalize you for people reading it in an RSS feed? I don't think they would, but and Enlistapart we still maintain as its own thing on its own server, but then we have an Enlistapart Medium component as well, so that because it's interesting, it's a different kind of writing about the kind of topics we're interested in. It might attract people who then read the regular publication. The regular publication might bring people to Medium. It's all good. It's all just connectivity, which, that's what the web is about.
Right.
What you've been doing this now since the 90s. And it's obviously changed a lot. What, for better or worse, is different to you than when you got started in the 90s? What's the most important thing that's different to you? Because we could spend all day just talking about all the differences.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know. I'm definitely at that point where I'm seeing the ebb and flow, like I talked about before, sort of the pendulum, doing a lot of swinging. And I'm happy to see a lot more collaboration. I think we went through a period where things were fairly siloed, and there was a desire to compartmentalize the design process. And so one of the things I like about a lot of the faster mindsets or attitudes towards design is this mindset that we need to all come together, and work collaboratively, multidisciplinary, which is how it worked when I got started. But we didn't know any better, right? It was just a bunch of people in a small office trying to figure out, how do we get this thing live? And I'll work on this part and you work on that part.
So. Yep. Or it was one person with multiple skills.
Yes.
I can design a little, I can write a little, I can code a little, so I'll make this happen somehow.
Right.
Which is very different now. I have to take a short commercial break. Hang in there. We're going to get to the bottom of a lot of interesting topics today. But first, I want to talk about the most interesting topic of all, which is food. and specifically Blue Apron. Blue Apron, if you don't know, is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting high standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. They've established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. They can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. Now, several folks in my design studio have started using Blue Apron, including a foodie who's the most particular person I know and really cares about quality and is the kind of person that would never, ever just run out for a fast lunch, even when he's starving, and would never just eat. You know, he's very conscious of what he puts in his body. He loves Blue Apron. My daughter, who is a notoriously fussy, picky eater, who basically loves cooking with me and has loved every Blue Apron dish we've tried, and I do too. The ingredients are really, really fresh, and nothing is wasted. Featured upcoming meals are salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli, pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple, spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. If you're a vegetarian like I am, vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla chips. There's always choice for different food needs. It's very affordable. It's less than $10 per person per meal. And, you know, the stuff comes in a box. You open the box, and it's really cool. There's like a tiny little bottle of a specific olive oil, a tiny little packet of just as much smoked paprika as you might need or whatever. It's really fun. You set the stuff aside. Really, if you have kids and if they're fussy or they're bored or you're bored or you've been eating greasy delivery food and you're trying to get healthier, this is a great alternative. My daughter actually, again, I mean, she said, have you ordered it this week? Have you ordered Blue Apron? Because, and like, not, you know, not prompted, not because they're a sponsor. She really does love it. Each meal comes with step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, which is very pretty, nicely designed. It's kind of a hard surface, so, you know, it doesn't, if you put it down on a wet counter or something, you can still read it. It's fine. I can't recommend it enough. I think it's a really, really great service. I'm very pleased to have them as a sponsor. And I think you should, if you're listening and you're at all interested in food or eating or existing, then check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/bigwebshow. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So please don't wait. That's blueapron.com/bigwebshow. Please do it. You'll be glad you did it. It's free food. It's like 3 days of free food. That's very good. Very good. blueapron.com/bigwebshow. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And we are back. We are back with Dan Brown, author of three books, including the most recent, Practical Design Discovery. For those who don't know, what is discovery and why is it important to design?
Discovery is, I describe it as kind of two halves. One is understanding the problem, and the other is presenting a, establishing a direction, setting a direction. You do it when maybe you have a vague idea of what you're trying to build, but you don't know exactly what it needs to look like or what you should focus on, what aspect you should prioritize. Discovery is that part of the process where we build what I call a pool of knowledge, right? Sort of this collective shared knowledge mm-hmm. that we can all draw upon when we're trying to make decisions during the design process. And the reason why that pool of knowledge is important is because, just like we were talking about before, the more people that are participating, the more we want a common foundation that we're all building on. And the reason why these two halves are important is what I've come to understand about creativity is and innovation is that you can't really understand a problem until you try and solve it at least a little bit. So by setting direction, we are starting to solve the problem, not getting to a fully fledged view or design of what it is, but at least a start to that process so that we can validate our understanding and then use that understanding to validate the direction that we're going in.
It almost sounds like a pattern library of knowledge or a style guide of knowledge, things we know to be true about our product or about our client's product. Am I wrong there? Am I way off base?
I don't think it's a bad analogy. I mean, H-Shapes, Nathan's work on H-Shapes is largely in the design system area.
Right.
I've always thought that the work is related insofar as a design system is kind of an infrastructure to build on, right? Sort of to draw from to make sure teams are working on their products in a cohesive way. But at the same time, I think discovery within a team creates that same kind of infrastructure that, as you say, is more conceptual or knowledge-based, so we feel more confident about the decisions that we're making.
So what's the difference between discovery and user research, customer research, market research, or UX strategy? Those are all, it seems like we can use those fairly interchangeably, but I don't know that we necessarily should. Where does discovery sit in that spectrum of stuff? Say versus research.
So I'm going to start by saying your mileage may vary because, I mean, these words as... I mean, even though Jeffrey, you and I have been doing this for a while, these words I don't think are still especially well defined. But here's how I think about it. Research is a tool that we use to inform the design process. And the way I've written the book is I don't really care what kind of research you've done, right? You've got tools to gather information and to make sense of that information and then to incorporate it into the work that you're doing. Whatever tools you use to do that, you know, be they, you know, quick, you know, card sorts or much more elaborate ethnographic studies.
Or electronic stuff too, don't forget.
Right, right. Well, when I say card sort, I think of electronic Optimal Workshop and Optimal Sort. But yeah, I mean, there's tons of electronic tools for doing this stuff now. So it contributes to that discovery process. I think the harder distinction to make is between discovery and UX strategy.
Right.
And I've been trying to read a little bit about how people are using the term UX strategy. I think by some definitions, I think the distinction is very slim, right? There's not a whole lot of difference between them, but here's how I think about it. I think with UX strategy, maybe we have less of an idea initially of what we're trying to accomplish. We know we've got this user group. We know their needs are not being met. We need to establish a strategy for meeting those needs. I think with discovery, my experience is that we go in with a little bit more of an understanding of what it is that we're trying to build, what it is we're trying to do. So you may do discovery to uncover a design direction for a new feature on an existing product, right? So you've got kind of an existing framework. Maybe you know, like I've done work for an industry association that serves conventional architects. And we know they need to go through a licensing process, but maybe we don't know exactly how we should reflect that through this web application that we designed. So there's
we don't know the laws about that either. I mean, so that part of it's research, right? You have to find out. So for example, we once wanted to change at my old studio. We wanted to change the front end of copyright because we found that using the government's copyright website was very cumbersome. So we wanted to build a front end on it, just using the government's website, but basically creating tools that would make it easier to. And we found out that we couldn't legally do that or even think about it, and we should just move away because for reasons I don't remember, but they had to do with law about,
yes.
Well, if you're not a lawyer, you can't do this. Basically, well, so basically lawyers built this interface, which is why it sucks, but you're not allowed to work on that interface if you're not a lawyer. I mean, there's all kinds of – every profession has its own arcane rules and regulations, some of which are – so in your architecture analogy, just finding out what you're allowed to do is also
yes.
part of it.
Yeah.
Sorry for the big digression. It just
No. It's useful. I mean, as you say, there are, and with architecture licensing, it's the jurisdictions are at the state level. So every state
right.
has its own set of rules. And how do we make this accessible for people? So I think discovery is there because.
And you succeeded in that project, by the way?
We are, I have ongoing relationship with this client.
Which is great.
And we finished a project called Portfolio that allows architects who are seeking a license but did not complete the education requirements established by the state to create a portfolio to demonstrate that they have sufficient knowledge to meet the education requirements.
Wow.
So it's very obscure, but I love projects like this because this is where discovery is crucial, right? I need to become an expert on this stuff. And I need to validate that the direction that we want to go in will make sense to these people who are dependent on this process for their livelihood. So,
wow. Now, what if the team isn't interested in doing discovery? How do you convince them it's a good idea?
You alluded to this at the beginning, right? And I think this is a really good strategy, which is let's just bite off a little piece, right? Let's make sure we understand what direction that we want to go in. Discovery was harder to sell back in the day because we treated it like a requirements process.
Right.
So the only thing that came out of the other end was this unusable tome. And, you know, we've long abandoned that. What we do have now is this idea that after doing discovery, we'll have stuck a stake in the ground in terms of here's the design direction to go in. We don't have all the details yet. We don't have, you know, every last little piece of the design spelled out, but you've got a stake in the ground. And if you like it, you know, great. And if not, you haven't invested so much that it was a complete waste of time. You've got at least that foundation, right? That initial understanding of what the problem is and where you could take it.
That is brilliant. And I do remember back in the day, I used to say we were cleaning up after the elephants, but, there was one of the earliest UX consultancies, very well respected and deservedly so, really brilliant people, a group of many people who were, you know, had written some of the most interesting thinking on the early in early UX and who seemed on a path that was rather adaptive to get together and make a company. Anyway, but these guys would do just what you said. They would do a discovery process. And at first, until I realized what they were doing and the value that it had, it used to kill me because they'd get about 3/4 of the client's budget writing, you know, a few pages that ended with bullet points.
Right.
Like, make these things. And then we'd come in and go, okay, so now we'll do the branding, the user interface design, the content strategy, the information architecture, the HTML, the CSS. You know, we're like, we'll do all that. And, you know, and it was like for what was left of the budget. But this gets back to the point we were talking about at the top of the show and why you've written this book in a way. It's like what we're making is the most important decision, much more right. so than the littler executional details. If we're right. making the wrong thing, it doesn't matter how pretty it is or how delightful the user interface, innovations might be.
Right. right.
If it's the wrong thing, it ain't going to work.
Right.
I like it. Now, in the book, you talk about a frame discovery framework. In fact, you introduce it and keep working with it in the book. Can you tell listeners about that?
Sure. When I was trying to wrap my head around discovery, I was doing so in sort of a few years ago when, you know, a lot of things that UX designers were talking about was how do I reconcile my process with this desire to move faster.
Right.
And what I kind of wanted to break down everything that we do in discovery and try and understand what purpose does it serve. The framework then came out of that process where my intent was to sort of break discovery down and say, here are the main things that we're trying to accomplish in discovery. And again, I don't care how you accomplish those things, but it helps you understand, you know, if you have one day to do discovery or 1 month or 1 quarter to do discovery, you need to accomplish these four things. And these four things are gathering, processing, exploring, and focusing. And the framework kind of spells out in a 2x2 approach why each of those things are important and how they all relate to each other. One question that I get when I do this in a workshop is, why isn't this in chronological order? Why haven't you given us a process for doing it?
Right.
And that largely came out of my research on creativity, which is you never know what's going to kick things off. You never know where you're going to start. So, you know, we always say we start with user research, but do we really? I mean, sometimes we start by brainstorming, right? And kind of thinking about what do we know about the problem?
Don't tell anyone. No, it's a it's a very scientific process what we do. We never brainstorm. No, of course we
never brainstorm.
Yeah,
right.
Of course we do.
But maybe we do a little tiny bit. No one's going to listen to this, right?
Right. Jeffrey's nobody true. Listens.
Yes. So we brainstorm a little bit, but that helps us ask better questions. So when we're gathering information, we know better questions to ask because we've done a little bit of exploring already. Well, once we've done that gathering, we can't really just use all of that raw data. We need to actually process it. And processing is really important because not only do we have a lot of raw data from our user research, but we may have a lot of raw data from gathering inputs from business stakeholders, from subject matter experts, from the technology team, right, from all of these other places. So processing allows us to put it all in place. And then we can go back to exploring. But we can't just brainstorm, right? We need to focus those efforts to turn it into a plan, right? Something that we can turn around and execute on. So these four things kind of all work together and smoosh around and in a sense represent different, not just processes, but different mindsets that we have as we go through discovery. So that's the basics of the framework.
Now, I love this because what you're doing, you're applying a structure to the free form thing that we all do, to the organic process that we all do. So to give an example right now, we're in early research on a new project. But at the same time, during a meeting today, we were talking about which component to design first.
Right.
And how, And sort of should we don't want to do wireframes. We've decided wireframes suck and we're going to do it like a comic book. We're going to do a sketch and have explanations, almost talk balloons saying what's happening. And now in the purest world, it's completely inappropriate to even talk about what page we're going to design first. We're in the middle of the research. So how do we know what we're going to design first? Except right. By now we've done enough research to know these are commonalities in these kinds of sites. This, from our research so far, this is where a lot of the greatest number of problems happen. This is the biggest problem to solve. This is an e-commerce category. And, you know, a product detail page is probably a great place to start. A faulty, you know, if you're having trouble with conversion, look there, right? Look at your search, look at your landing page, but especially look at if that's where people are breaking down. And not doing anything else, maybe it's because it's not clear what they can do. So we're still going to continue to research. We're still going to continue to ask questions. I wouldn't want anyone I interview, any stakeholder I interview, to think my mind's made up. My mind's still open. But today, at this moment, the evolution of my understanding of the design job I'm going to be doing is that would be a great place to start. It may evolve. It may change. Anyway, I love it because what you're really saying is you're not doing it wrong when you float from place to place. That's how the creative process is supposed to work.
Well, and the way I would, I love that story, and I think it's great because, you know, you've done a bunch of research. What would you rather do? Would you rather start drawing pictures, or would you rather kind of make a bulleted list of everything that you learned and then review that with your client in an abstract way? I think drawing pictures, as you're doing, allows you to talk more pragmatically about the things that you learned and really go back to what everyone took away from that research and hone it, right, and really understand what it is that they took away from it. So I think that's a great example. I mean, when you study creativity, what you realize is what we're trying to do is mimic or trying to reproduce these great moments in innovation, but on a much, much smaller scale. And those great moments of innovation didn't necessarily follow a particular process, right? They didn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily, you know, based on a statement of work that someone wrote for a client, right? They just kind of came out of the natural processes of human ingenuity. And that's what we're trying to capture and recreate, I believe. But we have to do that in the context of the business world, where the constraints are much, much more real and much more pragmatic. So.
That is beautiful. And I need to take another little break to thank another sponsor. May I do that?
Yeah, go for it. Okay. I love the Blue Apron one, so I'm excited.
Yeah, they're really good. They're really good. And so are these folks, FreshBooks. Now, when you're running your own agency, wrapping up one project and starting another means you need healthy cash flow to keep things moving, which is one of the hardest parts of running your own business. In fact, a lot of people quit freelancing or quit running small studios, not because they don't love the work, but just because it is so difficult to keep track of the money and keep paying people. Right. And if waiting for a client's check to show up in the mail is slowing your business down, it's time for FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes ridiculously easy to use cloud accounting software for agencies, studios, and freelancers. And it will help you become smarter. Sorry, work smarter. It won't help you become smarter. No product is that good. It'll help you work smarter, become more organized, and most importantly, get you paid quickly. Right. FreshBooks has been redesigned from the ground up and is custom built for the way you work. It get ready to, for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. They have a new projects feature that lets you share files and messages with your clients, contractors, and employees. And you can see how quickly things happen when you have all your conversations in one place. They do quick invoices. You can create and send really professional looking invoices in under 30 seconds. And when you email a client an invoice, FreshBooks can tell you whether they've seen it, which puts an end to the guessing games. Although you may have to be very diplomatic if they later lie and pretend they didn't get it. That's not from FreshBooks. That's just for me. FreshBooks would never say anything unpleasant like that. That's just me. There's also a notification center, like a personal assistant for you, that always lets you know what's changed in your business since you last logged in, and what needs to be dealt with pronto, like overdue invoices. So unless you have a partner who memorizes what's overdue and follows you around whispering in your ear all day long, and if you do, that might be creepy. So even so, go to FreshBooks and give it a try instead. To claim your month-long, unrestricted free trial, go to freshbooks.com/bigwebshow, and in the space where they say, "How did you hear about us?" type Big Web Show. Now, that's three separate words, Big Web Show, in the space, but it's all one word mushed together in the URL for obvious reasons, because we all know what URLs are. So again, to claim your month-long unrestricted free trial, go to freshbooks.com/bigwebshow and enter Big Web Show when they ask, "How did you hear about us?" Thank you, and we are back. I want to talk a little bit about the card game. You did this, Surviving Design Projects. Was it all you, or did you do this in collaboration with Nathan, or?
No, it was pretty much all me. I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff that I, not a lot, but, you know, I talk to Nathan about all kinds of stuff, and I talk to my colleagues at H-Shapes about all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, we may have had a brainstorming session or two where we where they kind of validated some of the ideas that I had around the different difficult situations that are captured in the card game and then some of the techniques that are captured in the card game.
Is it like, you know, Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies? Was it influenced by that, where basically almost if you're stuck here, draw a random card and get insight? Or is it more targeted to, with this behavior, do this, for this kind of conflict, do that?
It's it is a genuine game. So, I mean, it's, got us. Yeah, it's a set of rules. And I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of like Whose Line Is It Anyway, right? No one really cares who wins the game. It's just the process of playing the game is meant to be educational.
Is it for adults only? Is it naughty?
You know, no. I actually play tested it with my older son.
There you go.
Yeah, he was like the first beta tester.
And how old is he now?
He's now almost 11. He's 10, but at the time he must have been like
seven
or eight.
Wow.
Yeah. We play a lot of board games in this house. So this was sort of like, and it's based on an existing game called Apples to Apples, which is a great family game and a great party game. With Apples to Apples, you're given a concept that in the middle of the table, one person draws a card that's a concept, like flirtatious, say. And then everyone else has to play a card from their hand that's usually a noun that's sort of that they associate with this word. And so everyone around the table plays another card. And then the judge, the person who picked the card flirtatious, has to sort of pick one of those nouns that they think is most associated with it. So there's no real strategy or there's no real right answers, but you do want to play to the judge a little bit. In my game, it's a little different, where the judge describes a scenario based on a card that they draw. So let's say they draw the card distracted by shiny objects, right? So this is a situation that we often find ourselves in.
Oh, yes.
And was probably one of the very first situations I ever faced when, back in the day, JavaScript came out, and everyone wanted to talk about JavaScript, and no one wanted to talk about, you know, the user experience or the design of the thing or the structure of the thing.
And then repeat for Flash, repeat for apps.
Right. Yes, exactly. So we've been living this card for our entire careers. So they tell a story about that situation, and then everyone plays a technique that they can use to help the person who chose that situation deal with it. So they may pick a card like ask questions, right? That's kind of the most basic technique there is. So I might start asking like, well, why is it that you're interested in JavaScript for this thing? Or what is it about JavaScript that makes you focus on this? Everyone has a different technique, and then the person who played the situation picks the technique that they think works best. So it's essentially a storytelling game. The cards provide a framework for telling stories, and that in turn gives people an opportunity to show or describe how they would deal with these difficult situations.
Do you use that card game in the workshops that you run?
I used to when, you know, I mean, I don't mind telling you this, but selling workshops about collaboration and conflict is really hard.
Okay, why is that?
And I think, well, my wife told me that she said it's because people don't like admitting that they're bad at that. And I think she's really right. Because, you know, when you say to someone, you know, how's your collaboration skills? No one wants to say, oh, I'm a terrible collaborator. Or, you know, when you say to someone, like, when you get into a conflict, you know, how do you deal with that? You know, a lot of people just want to say, well, I'm always right, so I don't really get into conflicts.
So who thinks that? I can only think of one person, and someone we all know. But other than that person, who's a very powerful person in our government, I can't really think of anyone, any adult, any child over five, really, that thinks they're always right. Can you?
No, well, that's true. That's true. But I do feel like people struggle, don't want to admit that dealing with conflict is something that they want to work on, much less spend money on a workshop.
Sure.
On. That being said, I have done collaboration workshops. We do play the game, and it's fun. Actually, the way I use it mostly now is I go down to my local General Assembly, and I run a session with the students there. And it's usually like after their first group project, but before their second group project is how we try and time it, because a lot of them have never worked on a collaborative team before. And so it gives them a chance to kind of raise some of the issues that they faced.
Where do you live?
Washington, D.C. area.
That's right. I've got to get – if you're going to be in New York, let me know the next time you're going to be in New York. I teach a class at School of Visual Arts for interaction designers who are about to get their MFA, and I would love to have you come and talk to them sometime.
That would be a lot of fun.
It's a great class. The only issue is some of the smartest people who I get to bring in to speak don't live, you know, around the corner. So it has to be scheduled in advance. I think also one reason it's hard probably selling workshops is it's hard selling marketing to unicorns. And it's hard selling softer skills. I think softer skills are incredibly important. Like I said, the company that did a report and had three bullet points, that adaptive company I mentioned, they solved the most important problems before we even got to there. But at the same time, I think when people think about paying for an education, they think, oh, I've got to improve my JavaScript, or I've got to learn all the new frameworks. I've got to figure. I need to get better at Rails. It's easier to wrap your head around something like that.
Yes.
I think all of it's complicated. All of it requires great skill. None of it's easy. But I think it's easier to sell to maybe someone who's paying, maybe the boss. I need to get a handle on this complicated new technology. And the boss goes, I don't understand the technology at all. It might be easier to sell that to the boss than, hi, I want to study conflict resolution. You know, when I have a good idea and the people I work with are stupid and resist me, I want to get better at forcing my opinion on them. I'm not saying that, but, you know, it may be a harder sell.
Well, and a lot of large organizations already have that kind of training. One of the reasons why I created the game, and because I wrote the book, Designing Together, is I feel like as designers, we have a unique position in facilitating these conversations and a unique position in dealing with especially contentious issues. So I do like to think of designers as, having this kind of unique perspective.
Absolutely.
But to your point, and I think it's a great point that, you know, you say conflict resolution to an organization there and they say, well, I think, you know, we've got some HR training for you on that.
We have no conflicts here, or they think it's a suit or something.
Yes.
Yes. I want to take one quick pause to thank one last sponsor, and then we're going to get into our end game here. I thank you for your patience and all the wisdom you've shared with us thus far. And I just want to thank Wix.com, my very interesting final sponsor of the day. With Wix.com, you can create a website all by yourself, even if you don't know anything about design or code or anything that we've been talking about today. Or perhaps this is something that you get for a friend or a business associate who you can't consult for. So you turn them on to Wix.com, where anyone can create a website. It's easy. They just use the drag and drop editor to customize everything. Add your text, images, videos, and more. Wix makes it easy to get your stunning website looking exactly the way you want. No tech skills needed. Plus, your site is mobile optimized, so it'll look amazing on any device. Whatever you need a website for, Wix has you covered. The possibilities are endless. So start that blog or showcase your artistic talent in a beautiful portfolio. You can even grow your business with a stunning online store or simply explore new ideas. Now, get this. Over 97 million people choose Wix to create their website. Make yours happen this year. It's easy and free. Just go to Wix.com, that's W-I-X.com, and create your stunning website today. And I thank them, and we are back. So now that you've done your book on discovery, what's next for Dan Brown? What's on your mind these days?
I like having something kind of deeper or complicated to think about alongside my deep and complicated client projects. And I really read a lot about creativity while I was doing this book, which was great, but it struck me as a very complex and interesting topic. The discovery angle was useful and was great, and I'm really proud of the writing I did for this book to create a relationship between discovery and creativity and innovation. But what I feel like I didn't get a chance to talk about or was not appropriate to talk about in this book was leadership and the role of a creative leader in the design process. And what's interesting is that, you know, we think of creativity as the purview of a creative genius, right? Or a right. creative team. But we don't really dig into a larger team and the role of a creative leader on that. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think, you know, there's books out now on design leadership and
there's a conference about it. Andy right. Budd from Clear Leftist started a conference about it yep. in Brighton, I think.
Yep. And that adaptive company that we were talking about yes. runs Leading Experience out right. in San Francisco.
There we go.
So this is I'm definitely not alone in this, but I'm really interested in thinking about the role of a leader that isn't necessarily management related, right? It's and a lot of the times we kind of conflate management responsibilities with creative direction or creative leadership responsibilities. And I'm not saying those two things aren't related, but I kind of want to pull away that part of it and see.
They're not, and sometimes they aren't at all. I mean, right. the producers and especially the director of a film, yes, they have a big their management and they have a big oversized role to play. But, you know, the executive creative director at an ad agency may largely be responsible for schmoozing clients and checking budgets. And the great campaigns that win the awards might have been done by a junior team of art directors and copywriters. Right. You never know. And right. so, you know, the executive creative director's name goes on it, of course, like along with the juniors. But doesn't mean that they had that much to do with it. They might have approved it. They might not even have seen it before it went out. So you're right. It's not always, and it's certainly not necessarily the CEO who's going to solve the problem.
Right.
But there's this sort of – yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say there's this HR angle to management. There's this execution angle to management. Like how do I line things up to get the project done, but I still think there's something else there, this kind of establishing a vision, getting people aligned around that vision. I feel like there's a there, but I'm having trouble kind of zeroing in on the set of responsibilities that I have as a design leader to make that happen. So that's what I'm thinking about.
Is it going to be outside the organization, inside the organization, both?
I feel like, for better or for worse, you know, I'm an outie, so I always kind of think of it in those terms. But the discovery projects that I'm working on have me more embedded than normal on the projects that I'm working on. So I feel like I'm getting some exposure to how creative leaders behave both inside and outside an organization. So I don't know what this is going to become. I haven't even written publicly that much about it because I still feel like I don't have a good
you don't want to jinx it.
I don't have a handle on what I want to say, right? I don't feel like anyone's really.
Do you have a handle on what you want? So you want to do research, not necessarily discovery. You're still in research.
Well.
Or is this discovery? Did I just
Wow, you've just blown my mind. So what would discovery be in this, right? So I do a lot of reading about leadership, but I also write about it, but I write about it privately, right? So every morning, one of my routines is I write 750 words about whatever just pops out of my head.
That's why you're good.
Of the times, well, thank you, but it's a muscle that you have to exercise. Right. And so is it discovery? Yeah, because I do the research, but then as you said at the very beginning, sometimes you write to understand, right? You write to wrap your head around it, because by writing it out, you see it and feel it and experience it differently. It's like when we sketch screens, right? We draw them to make them tactile, to make them so we can, you know, get inside them and really understand them. And that's for me, writing three pages every morning lets me get inside these ideas.
And how you do that as a dad with two kids, I'm not sure, but that's really cool. I wanted to ask, it sounds like you do a fair amount of retainer work, or a fair amount of, you don't just come in, fix the problem and go away. It sounds like you have some projects where you're staying engaged, maybe every 3 months coming back to talk some more. I'm getting that impression. I don't really know how you folks run your business, but is that true? Are you doing more kind of repeat engagements?
Just to pull back the covers a little bit on how we work, we all of our agreements for the most part are statements of work about specific projects. So they have a budget cap, and we describe, you know, the kinds of deliverables that we'll produce, and, you know, the budget that we will adhere to and the activities that we will follow. I would rather sell to an existing client in many ways, because it's, for them, it's the devil they know. And for me, it means that I can keep my fingers in a project that I love. So.
And not only that, you've already done a great deal of discovery. Right. Again, and the work you did for them last time is now part of a larger discovery process. Right? Yeah, so everything you've done, whether it succeeded or failed, is part of discovery.
Yeah, I mean, I just had a great opportunity with this architecture client. I finished up the project with the portfolio work, and they asked me to kind of, you know, in a sense, dig even deeper into the organization and look at some of the underlying assumptions and technologies that they use to run the organization and run their processes. And it was not something I could have done on day one of my relationship with them, you know, whatever it was 5 years ago. It was, you know, after years of projects with them off and on, right? I mean, they come and they go, but I have a level of comfort and familiarity with not just the team, but with the subject matter too, where I felt like I could really bring some value to the table and sort of exposing some of the challenges and opportunities that they have. And that I see as more strategy work, right? There was no specific like, okay, now we can go forward building X. It was more, now we have a better lay of the land and we can make some better decisions about what to prioritize.
That's great. And you keep it manageable by still each of those things is a project with a specific budget cap, a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
A list of at least the type of deliverables you'll be giving.
Right.
Not necessarily these five templates, because that doesn't
right.
work. Great. Where can folks go to see you next?
Well, I'm always on Twitter, which is entertaining, but I think my next speaking engagement is actually
your Brown-O-Rama. Brown-O-Rama. Right.
Yes.
Also on Medium, you're Brown-O-Rama. Brown-O-Rama.
Brown-O-Rama. Everywhere, yeah.
And hshapes.com, obviously.
Yes. My next speaking engagement is actually here in D.C. There's a local UX conference that's fantastic. It's on April 15th of all dates.
Cool. Tax day.
Yes.
Yay.
And you can come directly to Washington, hand them your taxes directly, you know, shortcut the middleman there. No, I'm just kidding. So, because you want to come to this conference. So it's UXDC.
UXDC. Very good.
Here in April. Yeah.
How big is that?
They're getting bigger every year. It's several hundred people. We've got a really
nice,
vibrant community here in D.C. So
that's really cool. I will be there soon myself.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I love D.C. I used to live in D.C. I see keynote speaker Christina Wacky.
Yes, Christina's coming to town for UXDC.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. And it's 25 days, 17 hours, 48 minutes, and 2 seconds from now.
Yeah, we, you know, it's sort of like a CNN ticker kind of thing. Right. We really like our countdown clocks here in Washington.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's absolutely beautiful. Nice website. Micah is a sponsor of them. Cool. Very, very cool. Okay, so DC folks, UXDCconference.org. Go see Dan Brown and many other good people. Dan Brown, author of Discovery. Dan?
Yes.
I think we've done it. I think this is a wrap.
We have talked about everything we could possibly talk about.
Well, we talked about enough for now.
But we could probably keep going. Yes.
We could. I could. I don't know. I could. I think you could. Take care. Thank you very much. And listeners, we'll see you soon on another Big Web Show.